derived from the Middle English sangreal, and was eventually split into two words, san, greal, holy grail. Sophie was surprised she had not spotted the linguistic ties immediately. Even so, Langdon's claim still made no sense to her.
I thought the Holy Grail was a cup. You just told me the Sangreal is a collection of documents that reveal some dark secret.
Yes, but the Sangreal documents are only half of the Holy Grail treasure. They are buried with the Grail itself, and reveal its true meaning. The documents gave the Knights Templar so much power because the pages revealed the true nature of the Grail.
The true nature of the Grail?
Sophie felt even more lost now. The Holy Grail, she had thought, was the cup that Jesus drank from at the Last Supper, and with which Joseph of Arimathea later caught his blood at the crucifixion.
The Holy Grail is the cup of Christ, she said. How much simpler could it be?
Sophie, Langdon whispered, leaning toward her now. According to the Priory of Sion, the Holy Grail is not a cup at all. They claim the Grail legend, that of a chalice, is actually an ingeniously conceived allegory. That is, that the Grail story uses the chalice as a metaphor for something else, something far more powerful. He paused. Something that fits perfectly with everything your grandfather has been trying to tell us tonight, including all his symbolic references to the sacred feminine. Still unsure, Sophie sensed in Langdon's patient smile that he empathized with her skepticism, and yet his eyes remained earnest.
But if the Holy Grail is not a cup, she asked, what is it?
Langdon had known this question was coming, and yet he still felt uncertain exactly how to tell her. If he did not present the answer in the proper historical background, Sophie would be left with a vacant air of bewilderment, the exact expression Langdon had seen on his own editor's face a few months ago after Langdon handed him a draft of the manuscript he was working on.
This manuscript claims what?
His editor had choked, setting down his wine glass and staring across his half-eaten power lunch.
You can't be serious.
Serious enough to have spent a year researching it. Renowned New York editor Jonas Faulkman tugged nervously at his goatee. Faulkman, no doubt, had heard some wild book ideas in his illustrious career, but this one seemed to have left the man flabbergasted.
Robert, Faulkman finally said, don't get me wrong. I love your work, and we've had a great run together. But if I agree to publish an idea like this, I'll have people picketing outside my office for months. Besides, it will kill your reputation. You're a Harvard historian, for Christ's sake, not a pop schlockmeister looking for a quick buck. Where could you possibly find enough credible evidence to support a theory like this?
With a quiet smile, Langdon pulled a piece of paper from the pocket of his tweed coat and handed it to Faulkman. The page listed a bibliography of over 50 titles, books by well-known historians, some contemporary, some centuries old, many of them academic bestsellers. All the book titles suggested the same premise Langdon had just proposed. As Faulkman read down the list, he looked like a man who had just discovered the earth was actually flat.
I know some of these authors. They're real historians.
Langdon grinned. As you can see, Jonas, this is not only my theory. It's been around for a long time. I'm simply building on it. No book has yet explored the legend of the Holy Grail from a symbologic angle. The iconographic evidence I'm finding to support this theory is, well, staggeringly persuasive. Faulkman was still staring at the list.
My God! One of these books was written by Sir Lee Teabing, Britain's royal historian.
Teabing has spent much of his life studying the Holy Grail. I've met with him. He was actually a big part of my inspiration. He's a believer, Jonas, along with all of the others on that list.
You're telling me all of these historians actually believe?
Faulkman swallowed, apparently unable to say the words. Langdon grinned again. The Holy Grail is arguably the most sought-after treasure in human history. The Grail has spawned legends, wars, and lifelong quests. Does it make sense that it is merely a cup? If so, then certainly other relics should generate similar or greater interest. The crown of thorns, the true cross of the crucifixion, the titulus. And yet they do not. Throughout history, the Holy Grail has been the most special. Langdon grinned.
Now you know why.
Faulkman was still shaking his head.
But with all these books written about it, why isn't this theory more widely known?
These books can't possibly compete with centuries of established history, especially when that history is endorsed by the ultimate bestseller of all time.
Faulkman's eyes went wide. Don't tell me Harry Potter is actually about the Holy Grail.
I was referring to the Bible.
Faulkman cringed. I knew that.
Laissez-la.
Sophie's shouts cut the air inside the taxi.
Put it down.
Langdon jumped as Sophie leaned forward over the seat and yelled at the taxi driver. Langdon could see the driver was clutching his radio mouthpiece and speaking into it. Sophie turned now and plunged her hand into the pocket of Langdon's tweed jacket. Before Langdon knew what had happened, she had yanked out the pistol, swung it around, and was pressing it to the back of the driver's head. The driver instantly dropped his radio, raising his one free hand overhead.
Sophie! Langdon choked. What the hell?
Arrêtez!
Sophie commanded the driver. Trembling, the driver obeyed, stopping the car and putting it in park. It was then that Langdon heard the metallic voice of the taxi company's dispatch coming from the dashboard.
Qui s'appelle Agence Sophie Neveu, the radio crackled, est un Américain, Robert Langdon.
Langdon's muscles turned rigid.
They found us already?
Descendez,
Sophie demanded. The trembling driver kept his arms over his head as he got out of his taxi and took several steps backwards. Sophie had rolled down her window and now aimed the gun outside at the bewildered cabbie.
Robert, she said quietly, take the wheel. You're driving.
Langdon was not about to argue with a woman wielding a gun. He climbed out of the car and jumped back in behind the wheel. The driver was yelling curses, his arms still raised over his head.
Robert, Sophie said from the back seat, I trust you've seen enough of our magic forest?
He nodded. Plenty.
Good. Get us out of here.
Langdon looked down at the car's controls and hesitated.
Shit.
He groped for the stick shift and the clutch. Sophie, maybe you—
Go!
She yelled. Outside, several hookers were walking over to see what was going on. One woman was placing a call on her cell phone. Langdon depressed the clutch and jostled the stick into what he hoped was first gear. He touched the accelerator, testing the gas. Langdon popped the clutch. The tires howled as the taxi leapt forward, fishtailing wildly and sending the gathering crowd diving for cover. The woman with the cell phone leapt into the woods, only narrowly avoiding being run down.
Doucement!
Sophie said as the car lurched down the road.
What are you doing?
I tried to warn you, he shouted over the sounding of gnashing gears. I drive an automatic.
Chapter 39. Although the Spartan room in the brownstone on Rue La Bruyère had witnessed a lot of suffering, Silas doubted anything could match the anguish now gripping his pale body.
I was deceived. Everything's lost.
Silas had been tricked. The brothers had lied, choosing death instead of revealing their secret. Silas did not have the strength to call the teacher. Not only had Silas killed the only four people who knew where the keystone was hidden, he had killed a nun inside Saint-Sulpice.
She was working against the church. She scorned the work of Opus Dei.
A crime of impulse. The woman's death complicated matters greatly. Bishop Aringarosa had placed the phone call that got Silas into Saint-Sulpice. What would the abbe think when he discovered the nun was dead? Although Silas had placed her back in her bed, the wound on her head was obvious. Silas had attempted to replace the broken tiles in the floor, but that too was obvious. They would know someone had been there. Silas had planned to hide within Opus Dei when his task here was complete.
Bishop Aringarosa will protect me.
Silas could imagine no more blissful existence than a life of meditation and prayer deep within the walls of Opus Dei's headquarters in New York City. He would never again set foot outside. Everything he needed was within that sanctuary.
Nobody will miss me.
Unfortunately, Silas knew, a prominent man like Bishop Aringarosa could not disappear so easily.
I have endangered the bishop,
Silas gazed blankly at the floor and pondered taking his own life. After all, it had been Aringarosa who gave Silas life in the first place, in that small rectory in Spain, educating him, giving him purpose. "My friend," Aringarosa had told him, "you were born an albino. Do not let others shame you for this. Do you not understand how special this makes you? Were you not aware that Noah himself was an albino?"
"Noah? Of the Ark?"
Silas had never heard this. Aringarosa was smiling. "Indeed, Noah of the Ark, an albino. Like you, he had skin white like an angel. Consider this. Noah saved all of life on the planet. You are destined for great things, Silas. The Lord has freed you for a reason. You have your calling. The Lord needs your help to do his work." Over time, Silas learned to see himself in a new light.
"I am pure, white, beautiful, like an angel."
At the moment, though, in his room at the residence hall, it was his father's disappointed voice that whispered to him from the past.
"Tu es un tragique désastre, un spectre."
Kneeling on the wooden floor, Silas prayed for forgiveness. Then, stripping off his robe, he reached again for the discipline. Chapter 40. Struggling with the gear shift, Langdon managed to maneuver the hijacked taxi to the far side of the Bois de Boulogne, while only stalling twice. Unfortunately, the inherent humor in the situation was overshadowed by the taxi dispatcher repeatedly hailing their cab over the radio.
"Voiture 563, où êtes-vous? Répondez!"
When Langdon reached the exit of the park, he swallowed his machismo and jammed on the brakes.
"You'd better drive."
Sophie looked relieved as she jumped behind the wheel. Within seconds, she had the car humming smoothly westward along Allée de Longchamp, leaving the Garden of Earthly Delights behind. "Which way is Rue Haxo?" Langdon asked, watching Sophie edge the speedometer over 100 kilometers an hour. Sophie's eyes remained focused on the road.
"The cab driver said it's adjacent to the Roland-Garros tennis stadium. I know that area."
Langdon pulled the heavy key from his pocket again, feeling the weight in his palm. He sensed it was an object of enormous consequence, quite possibly the key to his own freedom. Earlier, while telling Sophie about the Knights Templar, Langdon had realized that this key, in addition to having the priory seal embossed on it, possessed a more subtle tie to the Priory of Sion. The equal-armed cruciform was symbolic of balance and harmony, but also of the Knights Templar. Everyone had seen the paintings of Knights Templar wearing white tunics emblazoned with bright red equal-armed crosses. Granted, the arms of the Templar cross were slightly flared at the ends, but they were still of equal length.
A square cross, just like the one on this key.
Langdon felt his imagination starting to run wild as he fantasized about what they might find.
The Holy Grail.
He almost laughed out loud at the absurdity of it. The Grail was believed to be somewhere in England, buried in a hidden chamber beneath one of the many Templar churches, where it had been hidden since at least 1500.
The era of Grandmaster da Vinci.
The priory, in order to keep their powerful documents safe, had been forced to move them many times in the early centuries. Historians now suspected as many as 6 different Grail relocations since its arrival in Europe from Jerusalem. The last Grail sighting had been in 1447, when numerous eyewitnesses described a fire that had broken out and almost engulfed the documents before they were carried to safety in 4 huge chests that each required 6 men to carry. After that, nobody claimed to see the Grail ever again. All that remained were occasional whisperings that it was hidden in Great Britain, the land of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. Wherever it was, 2 important facts remained. Leonardo knew where the Grail resided during his lifetime. That hiding place had probably not changed to this day. For this reason, Grail enthusiasts still pored over da Vinci's art and diaries in hopes of unearthing a hidden clue as to the Grail's current location. Some claimed the mountainous backdrop in Madonna of the Rocks matched the topography of a series of cave-ridden hills in Scotland. Others insisted that the suspicious placement of disciples in the Last Supper was some kind of code. Still others claimed that X-rays of the Mona Lisa revealed she originally had been painted wearing a lapis lazuli pendant of Isis, a detail Da Vinci purportedly later decided to paint over. Langdon had never seen any evidence of the pendant, nor could he imagine how it could possibly reveal the Holy Grail, and yet Grail aficionados still discussed it ad nauseam on internet bulletin boards and chat rooms. Everyone loves a conspiracy. And the conspiracies kept coming. Most recently, of course, had been the earth-shaking discovery that Da Vinci's famed Adoration of the Magi was hiding a dark secret beneath its layers of paint. Italian art diagnostician Maurizio Seracini had unveiled the unsettling truth in April of 2002, and news resonated loudly enough to appear that very week in a New York Times magazine story titled The Leonardo Cover-Up. Seracini had revealed beyond any doubt that while the Adoration's gray-green sketched underdrawing was indeed Da Vinci's work, the painting itself was not. The truth was that some anonymous painter had filled in Da Vinci's sketch like a paint-by-numbers years after Da Vinci's death. Far more troubling, however, was what lay beneath the imposter's paint. Allegedly, photographs taken with infrared reflectography and X-ray suggested that this rogue painter, while filling in Da Vinci's sketched study, had made suspicious departures from the underdrawing, as if to subvert Da Vinci's true intention. Whatever the true nature of the underdrawing, it had yet to be made public. Even so, embarrassed officials at Florence's Uffizi Gallery immediately banished the painting to a warehouse across the street. Visitors at the gallery's Leonardo room now found a misleading and unapologetic plaque where the Adoration once hung. This work is undergoing diagnostic tests in preparation for restoration. In the bizarre underworld of modern grail seekers, Leonardo da Vinci remained the quest's great enigma. His artwork seemed bursting to tell a secret, and yet, whatever it was remained hidden, perhaps beneath a layer of paint, perhaps enciphered in plain view, or perhaps nowhere at all. Da Vinci's plethora of tantalizing clues was nothing but an empty promise left behind to frustrate the curious and bring a smirk to the face of his knowing Mona Lisa.
"Is it possible," Sophie asked, drawing Langdon back, "that the key you're holding unlocks the hiding place of the Holy Grail?"
Langdon's laugh sounded forced even to him. "I can't really imagine. Besides, the Grail is believed to be hidden in the United Kingdom somewhere, not France." He gave her the quick history.
"But the Grail seems the only rational conclusion," she insisted. "We have an extremely secure key, stamped with the Priory of Sion seal, delivered to us by a member of the Priory of Sion, a brotherhood which, you just told me, are guardians of the Holy Grail."
Langdon knew her contention was logical, and yet intuitively, he could not possibly accept it. Rumors existed that the Priory had vowed someday to bring the Grail back to France to a final resting place, but certainly no historical evidence existed to suggest that this indeed had happened. Even if the Priory had indeed managed to bring the Grail back to France, the address 24 Rue Haxo, near a tennis stadium, hardly sounded like a noble final resting place. "Sophie, I really don't see how this key could have anything to do with the Grail."
"Because the Grail is supposed to be in England?"
"Not only that. The location of the Holy Grail is one of the best-kept secrets in history. Priory members wait decades proving themselves trustworthy before being elevated to the highest echelons of the fraternity and learning where the Grail is. That secret is protected by an intricate system of compartmentalized knowledge, and although the Priory Brotherhood is very large, only 4 members at any given time know where the Grail is hidden. The Grand Master and his 3 seneschals. The probability of your grandfather being one of those 4 top people is very slim."
"My grandfather was one of them," Sophie thought, pressing down on the accelerator.
She had an image seared in her memory that confirmed her grandfather's status within the Brotherhood beyond any doubt. "And even if your grandfather were in the upper echelon, he would never be allowed to reveal anything to anyone outside the Brotherhood. It is inconceivable that he would bring you into the inner circle."
"I've already been there," Sophie thought, picturing the ritual in the basement.
She wondered if this were the moment to tell Langdon what she had witnessed that night in the mountain chateau. For 10 years now, simple shame had kept her from telling a soul. Just thinking about it, she shuddered. Sirens howled somewhere in the distance, and she felt a thickening shroud of fatigue settling over her.
There,
Langdon said, feeling excited to see the huge complex of Roland Garros tennis stadium looming ahead. Sophie snaked her way toward the stadium. After several passes, they located the intersection of Rue Haxo and turned onto it, driving in the direction of the lower numbers. The road became more industrial, lined with businesses.
We need number 24, Langdon told himself, realizing he was secretly scanning the horizon for the spires of a church. Don't be ridiculous. A forgotten Templar church in this neighborhood?
There it is,
Sophie exclaimed, pointing. Langdon's eyes followed her arm to the structure ahead.
What in the world?
The building was modern, a squat citadel with a giant neon equal-armed cross emblazoned atop its facade. Beneath the cross were the words, Depository Bank of Zurich. Langdon was thankful not to have shared his Templar Church hopes with Sophie. A career hazard of symbologists was a tendency to extract hidden meaning from places that had none. In this case, Langdon had entirely forgotten that the peaceful, equal-armed cross had been adopted as the perfect symbol for the flag of neutral Switzerland. At least the mystery was solved. Sophie and Langdon were holding the key to a Swiss bank deposit box. Chapter 41. Outside Castel Gandolfo, an updraft of mountain air gushed over the top of the cliff and across the high bluff, sending a chill through Bishop Aringarosa as he stepped from the Fiat.
I should have worn more than this cassock, he thought, fighting the reflex to shiver.
The last thing he needed to appear tonight was weak or fearful. The castle was dark save the windows at the very top of the building, which glowed ominously.
The library, Aringarosa thought. They are awake and waiting.
He ducked his head against the wind and continued on without so much as a glance toward the observatory domes, which he was certain still resembled two infected goiters on the roof. The priest who greeted him at the door looked sleepy. He was the same priest who had greeted Aringarosa 5 months ago, albeit tonight he did so with much less hospitality.
We were worried about you, Bishop,
the priest said, checking his watch and looking more perturbed than worried.
My apologies. Airlines are so unreliable these days.
The priest mumbled something inaudible and then said,
They are waiting upstairs. I will escort you up.
The library was a gaping square room with dark wood from floor to ceiling. On all sides, towering bookcases burgeoned with volumes. The floor was amber marble with black basalt trim, a handsome reminder that this building had once been a palace.
Welcome, Bishop, a man's voice said from across the room.
Aringarosa tried to see who had spoken, but the lights were ridiculously low, much lower than they had been on his first visit, when everything was ablaze.
The night of stark awakening.
Tonight these men sat in the shadows, as if they were somehow ashamed of what was about to transpire. Aringarosa entered slowly, regally even. He could see the shapes of three men at a long table on the far side of the room. The silhouette of the man in the middle was immediately recognizable. The obese Secretariat Vaticana, overlord of all legal matters within Vatican City. The other two were high-ranking Italian cardinals. Aringarosa crossed the library toward them.
My humble apologies for the hour. We're on different time zones. You must be tired.
Not at all, the Secretariat said, his hands folded on his enormous belly.
We are grateful you have come so far. The least we can do is be awake to meet you. Can we offer you some coffee or refreshments?
I'd prefer we don't pretend this is a social visit. I have another plane to catch. Shall we get to business?
Of course, the Secretariat said.
You have acted more quickly than we imagined.
Have I?
You still have a month.
You made your concerns known 5 months ago, Aringarosa said. Why should I wait?
Indeed, we are very pleased with your expediency.
Aringarosa's eyes traveled the length of the long table to a large black briefcase.
Is that what I requested?
It is.
The Secretariat sounded uneasy.
Although I must admit we are concerned with the request, it seems quite...
Dangerous, one of the cardinals finished. Are you certain we cannot wire it to you somewhere? The sum is exorbitant.
Freedom is expensive.
I have no concerns for my own safety. God is with me. The men actually looked doubtful.
The funds are exactly as I requested? The secretariat nodded.
Large denomination bearer bonds drawn on the Vatican Bank, negotiable as cash anywhere in the world.
Ringarosa walked to the end of the table and opened the briefcase. Inside were two thick stacks of bonds, each embossed with the Vatican seal, and the title Portatore, making the bonds redeemable to whomever was holding them. The secretariat looked tense.
I must admit, Bishop, all of us would feel less apprehensive if these funds were in cash.
I could not lift that much cash, Ringarosa thought, closing the case.
Bonds are negotiable as cash. You said so yourself.
The cardinals exchanged uneasy looks, and finally one said,
Yes, but these bonds are traceable directly to the Vatican Bank.
Ringarosa smiled inwardly. That was precisely the reason the teacher suggested Ringarosa get the money in Vatican Bank bonds. It served as insurance.
We are all in this together now.
This is a perfectly legal transaction, Ringarosa defended. Opus Dei is a personal prelature of Vatican City, and His Holiness can disperse monies however he sees fit. No law has been broken here.
True, and yet...
The secretariat leaned forward, and his chair creaked under the burden.
We have no knowledge of what you intend to do with these funds, and if it is in any way illegal,
considering what you are asking of me, Ringarosa countered, what I do with this money is not your concern.
There was a long silence.
They know I'm right, Ringarosa thought.
Now, I imagine you have something for me to sign? They all jumped, eagerly pushing the paper toward him, as if they wished he would simply leave.
Ringarosa eyed the sheet before him. It bore the papal seal.
This is identical to the copy you sent me?
Exactly.
Ringarosa was surprised how little emotion he felt as he signed the document. The three men present, however, seemed to sigh in relief.
Thank you, Bishop, the secretariat said. Your service to the church will never be forgotten.
Ringarosa picked up the briefcase, sensing promise and authority in its weight. The four men looked at one another for a moment, as if there were something to say. But apparently there was not. Ringarosa turned and headed for the door.
Bishop,
one of the cardinals called out as Ringarosa reached the threshold.
Ringarosa paused, turning.
Yes? Where will you go from here?
Ringarosa sensed the query was more spiritual than geographical. And yet he had no intention of discussing morality at this hour.
Paris, he said, and walked out the door.
Chapter 42. The Depository Bank of Zurich was a 24-hour Geldschrankbanker, offering the full modern array of anonymous services in the tradition of the Swiss numbered account. Maintaining offices in Zurich, Kuala Lumpur, New York, and Paris, the bank had expanded its services in recent years to offer anonymous computer source code escrow services and faceless digitized backup. The bread and butter of their operation was by far their oldest and simplest offering, the Lagern Anonymen, blind drop services, otherwise known as anonymous safe deposit boxes. Clients wishing to store anything from stock certificates to valuable paintings could deposit their belongings anonymously, through a series of high-tech veils of privacy, withdrawing items at any time, also in total anonymity. As Sophie pulled the taxi to a stop in front of their destination, Langdon gazed out at the building's uncompromising architecture and sensed the Depository Bank of Zurich was a firm with little sense of humor. The building was a windowless rectangle that seemed to be forged entirely of dull steel, resembling an enormous metal brick. The edifice sat back from the road with a 15-foot-tall neon equilateral cross glowing over its facade. Switzerland's reputation for secrecy in banking had become one of the country's most lucrative exports. Facilities like this had become controversial in the art community because they provided a perfect place for art thieves to hide stolen goods, for years if necessary, until the heat was off. Because deposits were protected from police inspection by privacy laws and were attached to numbered accounts rather than people's names, thieves could rest easily knowing their stolen goods were safe and could never be traced to them. Sophie stopped the taxi at an imposing gate that blocked the bank's driveway. A cement-lined ramp descended beneath the building. A video camera overhead was aimed directly at them. Langdon had the feeling that this camera, unlike those at the Louvre, was authentic. Sophie rolled down the window and surveyed the electronic podium on the driver's side. An LCD screen provided directions in 7 languages. Topping the list was English. Insert key. Sophie took the gold laser-pocked key from her pocket and turned her attentions back to the podium. Below the screen was a triangular hole.
"Something tells me it will fit," Langdon said.
Sophie aligned the key's triangular shaft with the hole and inserted it, sliding it in until the entire shaft had disappeared. This key apparently required no turning. Instantly, the gate began to swing silently open. Sophie took her foot off the brake and coasted down to a second gate and podium. Behind her, the first gate closed, trapping them like a ship in a lock. Langdon disliked the constricted sensation.
"Let's hope this second gate works, too."
This second podium bore familiar directions.
Insert key.
When Sophie inserted the key, the second gate immediately opened. Moments later, they were winding down the ramp into the belly of the structure. The private garage was small and dim, with spaces for about 12 cars. At the far end, Langdon spied the building's main entrance. A red carpet stretched across the cement floor, welcoming visitors to a huge door that appeared to be forged of solid metal.
"Talk about mixed messages," Langdon thought. "Welcome, and keep out."
Sophie pulled the taxi into a parking space near the entrance and killed the engine.
"You'd better leave the gun here."
"With pleasure," Langdon thought, sliding the semi-automatic under the seat.
Sophie and Langdon got out and walked up the red carpet toward the slab of steel. The door had no handle, but on the wall beside the door, there was another triangular keyhole. No directions were posted this time.
"Keeps out the slow learners," Langdon said.
Sophie laughed, looking nervous.
"Here we go."
She stuck the key in the hole, and the door swung inward with a low hum. Exchanging glances, Sophie and Langdon entered. The door shut with a thud behind them. The foyer of the Depository Bank of Zurich employed as imposing a decor as any Langdon had ever seen. Where most banks were content with the usual polished marble and granite, this one had opted for wall-to-wall steel and rivets.
"Who's their decorator?" Langdon wondered. "Allied Steel?"
Sophie looked equally intimidated as her eyes scanned the lobby. The gray metal was everywhere. The floor, walls, counters, doors, even the lobby chairs appeared to be fashioned of molded iron. Nonetheless, the effect was impressive. The message was clear. "You are walking into a vault." A large man behind the counter glanced up as they entered. He turned off the small television he was watching and greeted them with a pleasant smile. Despite his enormous muscles and visible sidearm, his diction chimed with the polished courtesy of a Swiss bellman.
"Bonsoir," he said. "How may I help you?"
The dual-language greeting was the newest hospitality trick of the European host. It presumed nothing and opened the door for the guest to reply in whichever language was more comfortable. Sophie replied with neither. She simply laid the gold key on the counter in front of the man. The man glanced down and immediately stood straighter.
"Of course. Your elevator is at the end of the hall. I will alert someone that you are on your way."
Sophie nodded and took her key back.
"Which floor?"
The man gave her an odd look.
"Your key instructs the elevator which floor."
She smiled.
"Ah, yes."
The guard watched as the two newcomers made their way to the elevators, inserted their key, boarded the lift, and disappeared. As soon as the door had closed, he grabbed the phone. He was not calling to alert anyone of their arrival. There was no need for that. A vault greeter already had been alerted automatically when the client's key was inserted outside in the entry gate. Instead, The guard was calling the bank's night manager. As the line rang, the guard switched the television back on and stared at it. The news story he had been watching was just ending. It didn't matter. He got another look at the two faces on the television. The manager answered.
Oui?
We have a situation down here.
What's happening?
The manager demanded. The French police are tracking two fugitives tonight.
So?
Both of them just walked into our bank. The manager cursed quietly.
Okay. I'll contact Monsieur Vernet immediately.
The guard then hung up and placed a second call. This one, to Interpol. Langdon was surprised to feel the elevator dropping rather than climbing. He had no idea how many floors they had descended beneath the Depository Bank of Zurich before the door finally opened. He didn't care. He was happy to be out of the elevator. Displaying impressive alacrity, a male host was already standing there to greet them. He was elderly and pleasant, wearing a neatly pressed flannel suit that made him look oddly out of place, an old-world banker in a high-tech world.
Bonsoir, the man said. Good evening. Would you be so kind as to follow me, s'il vous plaît?
Without waiting for a response, he spun on his heel and strode briskly down a narrow metal corridor. Langdon walked with Sophie down a series of corridors, past several large rooms filled with blinking mainframe computers.
Voici,
their host said, arriving at a steel door and opening it for them.
Here you are.
Langdon and Sophie stepped into another world. The small room before them looked like a lavish sitting room at a fine hotel. Gone were the metal and rivets, replaced with oriental carpets, dark oak furniture, and cushioned chairs. On the broad desk in the middle of the room, two crystal glasses sat beside an opened bottle of Perrier, its bubbles still fizzing. A pewter pot of coffee steamed beside it. Clockwork, Langdon thought. Leave it to the Swiss. The man gave a knowing smile.
I sense this is your first visit to us?
Sophie hesitated and then nodded.
Understood. Keys are often passed on as inheritance, and our first-time users are invariably uncertain of the protocol.
He motioned to the table of drinks.
This room is yours as long as you care to use it.
You say keys are sometimes inherited? Sophie asked.
Indeed. Your key is like a Swiss numbered account, which are often willed through generations. On our gold accounts, the shortest safety deposit box lease is 50 years, paid in advance. So we see plenty of family turnover.
Langdon stared. Did you say 50 years?
At a minimum, their host replied. Of course, you can purchase much longer leases, but barring further arrangements, if there is no activity on the account for 50 years, the contents of that safe deposit box are automatically destroyed. Shall I run through the process of accessing your box?
Sophie nodded.
Please.
Their host swept an arm across the luxurious salon.
This is your private viewing room. Once I leave the room, the doors will lock behind me. You may spend all the time you need in here to review and modify the contents of your safe deposit box, which arrives over here.
He walked them to the far wall where a wide conveyor belt entered the room in a graceful curve, vaguely resembling a baggage claim carousel.
You insert your key in that slot there.
The man pointed to a large electronic podium facing the conveyor belt. The podium had a familiar triangular hole.
Once the computer confirms the markings on your key, you enter your account number, and your safe deposit box will be retrieved robotically from the vault below for your inspection. When you are finished with your box, you place it back on the conveyor belt, insert your key again, and the process is reversed. Because everything is automated, your privacy is guaranteed, even from the staff of this bank. If you need anything at all, simply press the call button on the table in the center of the room.
Sophie was about to ask a question when a telephone rang. The man looked puzzled and embarrassed.
Excuse me, please.
He walked over to the phone, which was sitting on the table beside the coffee and the Perrier.
Oui,
he answered. His brow furrowed as he listened to the caller.
Oui.
Oui.
D'accord.
He hung up, giving them an uneasy, tight smile.
I'm sorry, I must leave you now. Make yourselves at home.
He moved quickly toward the door.
Excuse me, Sophie called. Could you clarify something before you go? You mentioned that we enter an account number?
The man paused at the door, looking pale.
But of course. Like most Swiss banks, our safe deposit boxes are attached to a number, not a name. You have a key and a personal account number known only to you. Your key is only half of your identification. Your personal account number is the other half. Otherwise, if you lost your key, anyone could use it.
Sophie hesitated.
And if my benefactor gave me no account number?
The banker's heart pounded.
Then you obviously have no business here.
He gave them a calm smile.
I will ask someone to help you. He will be in shortly.
Leaving, the banker closed the door behind him and twisted a heavy lock, sealing them inside. Across town, Calais was standing in the Gare du Nord train terminal when his phone rang. It was Fache.
Interpol got a tip, he said. Forget the train. Langdon and Neveu just walked into the Paris branch of the Depository Bank of Zurich. I want your men over there right away.
Any leads yet on what Sonnier was trying to tell Agent Neveu and Robert Langdon?
Fache's tone was cold.
If you arrest them, Lieutenant Collet, then I can ask them personally.
Collet took the hint.
24 Rue Axo. Right away, Captain.
He hung up and radioed his men. Chapter 43. André Vernet, president of the Paris branch of the Depository Bank of Zurich, lived in a lavish flat above the bank. Despite his plush accommodations, he had always dreamed of owning a waterfront private home on l'Île Saint-Louis, where he could rub shoulders with the true cognoscenti, rather than here, where he simply met the filthy rich.
When I retire, Vernet told himself, I will fill my cellar with rare Bordeaux, adorn my salon with a Botticelli or two, and plant my garden with whatever I wish.
Tonight, Vernet had been awake only 6.5 minutes. Even so, as he hurried through the bank's underground corridor, he looked as if his personal tailor and hairdresser had polished him to a fine sheen. Impeccably dressed in a silk suit, Vernet sprayed some breath spray in his mouth and tightened his tie as he walked. No stranger to being awoken to attend to his international clients arriving from different time zones, Vernet modeled his sleep habits after the Maasai warriors, the African tribe famous for their ability to rise from the deepest sleep to a state of total battle readiness in a matter of seconds.
Battle ready,
Vernet thought, fearing the comparison might be uncharacteristically apt tonight. The arrival of a gold-key client always required an extra flurry of attention, but the arrival of a gold-key client who was wanted by the judicial police would be an extremely delicate matter. The bank had enough battles with law enforcement over the privacy rights of their clients without proof that some of them were criminals.
5 minutes, Vernet told himself. I need these people out of my bank before the police arrive.
If he moved quickly, this impending disaster could be deftly sidestepped. Vernet could tell the police that the fugitives in question had indeed walked into his bank as reported, but because they were not clients and had no account number, they were turned away. He wished the damned watchman had not called Interpol. Discretion was apparently not part of the vocabulary of a 15-euro-per-hour watchman. Stopping at the doorway, he took a deep breath and loosened his muscles. Then, forcing a balmy smile, he unlocked the door and swirled into the room like a warm breeze.
Good evening, he said, his eyes finding his clients. I am André Vernet. How can I be of service?
The rest of the sentence lodged somewhere beneath his Adam's apple. The woman before him was as unexpected a visitor as Vernet had ever had.
I'm sorry. Do we know each other? Sophie asked.
She did not recognize the banker, but he, for a moment, looked as if he'd seen a ghost.
No, the bank president fumbled. I don't believe so. Our services are anonymous.
He exhaled and forced a calm smile.
My assistant tells me you have a gold key but no account number. Might I ask how you came by this key?
My grandfather gave it to me,
Sophie replied, watching the man closely. His uneasiness seemed more evident now.
Really? Your grandfather gave you the key but failed to give you the account number?
I don't think he had time, Sophie said. He was murdered tonight.
Her words sent the man staggering backwards.
Jacques Saunier is dead?
He demanded, his eyes filling with horror.
But how?
Now it was Sophie who reeled, numb with shock.
You knew my grandfather?
Banker André Vernet looked equally astounded, steadying himself by leaning on an end table.
Jacques and I were dear friends. When did this happen?
Earlier this evening, inside the Louvre.
Vernet walked to a deep leather chair and sank into it.
I need to ask you both a very important question.
He glanced up at Langdon, then back to Sophie.
Did either of you have anything to do with his death?
No, Sophie declared. Absolutely not.
Vernet's face was grim, and he paused, pondering.
Your pictures are being circulated by Interpol. You're wanted for a murder.
Sophie slumped.
Flash ran an Interpol broadcast already?
It seemed the captain was more motivated than Sophie had anticipated. She quickly told Vernet who Langdon was and everything that had happened inside the Louvre tonight. Vernet looked amazed.
And as your grandfather was dying, he left you a message telling you to find Mr. Langdon?
Yes, and this key.
Sophie laid the gold key on the coffee table in front of Vernet, placing the priory seal face down. Vernet glanced at the key, but made no move to touch it.
He left you only this key? Nothing else? No slip of paper?
Sophie knew she had been in a hurry inside the Louvre, but she was certain she had seen nothing else behind Madonna of the Rocks.
No, just the key.
Vernet gave a helpless sigh.
I'm afraid every key is electronically paired with a 10-digit account number that functions as a password. Without that number, your key is worthless.
10 digits.
Sophie reluctantly calculated the cryptographic odds.
Over 10 billion possible choices.
Even if she could bring in DCPJ's most powerful parallel processing computers, she would still need weeks to break the code.
Certainly, monsieur. Considering the circumstances, you can help us.
I'm sorry. I truly can do nothing. Clients select their own account numbers via a secure terminal, meaning account numbers are known only to the client and computer. This is one way we ensure anonymity and the safety of our employees.
Sophie understood. Convenience stores did the same thing. Employees do not have keys to the safe. This bank obviously did not want to risk someone stealing a key and then holding an employee hostage for the account number. Sophie sat down beside Langdon, glanced down at the key, and then up at Vernet.
Do you have any idea what my grandfather is storing in your bank?
None whatsoever. That is the definition of a Geldschrankbanker.
Monsieur Vernet, she pressed, our time tonight is short. I'm going to be very direct, if I may.
She reached out to the gold key and flipped it over, watching the man's eyes as she revealed the Priory of Sion seal.
Does the symbol on this key mean anything to you?
Vernet glanced down at the fleur-de-lis seal and made no reaction.
No, but many of our clients emboss corporate logos or initials onto their keys.
Sophie sighed, still watching him carefully.
This seal is the symbol of a secret society known as the Priory of Sion.
Vernet again made no reaction.
I know nothing of this. Your grandfather was a friend, but we spoke mostly of business.
The man adjusted his tie, looking nervous now.
Monsieur Vernet, Sophie pressed, her tone firm, my grandfather called me tonight and told me he and I were in grave danger. He said he had to give me something. He gave me a key to your bank. Now he is dead. Anything you can tell us would be helpful.
Vernet broke a sweat.
We need to get out of the building. I'm afraid the police will arrive shortly. My watchman felt obliged to call Interpol.
Sophie had feared as much. She took one last shot.
My grandfather said he needed to tell me the truth about my family. Does that mean anything to you?
Mademoiselle, your family died in a car accident when you were young. I'm sorry. I know your grandfather loved you very much. He mentioned to me several times how much it pained him that you two had fallen out of touch.
Sophie was uncertain how to respond. Langdon asked, Do the contents of this account have anything to do with the Sangreal? Vernet gave him an odd look.
I have no idea what that is.
Vernet's cell phone rang, and he snatched it off his belt.
Oui?
He listened a moment, his expression one of surprise and growing concern.
La police? Si rapidement?
He cursed, gave some quick directions in French, and said he would be up to the lobby in a minute. Hanging up the phone, he turned back to Sophie.
The police have responded far more quickly than usual. They are arriving as we speak.
Sophie had no intention of leaving empty-handed.
Tell them we came and went already. If they want to search the bank, demand a search warrant. That will take them time.
Listen, Vernet said. Jacques was a friend, and my bank does not need this kind of press, so for those two reasons, I have no intention of allowing this arrest to be made on my premises. Give me a minute, and I will see what I can do to help you leave the bank undetected. Beyond that, I cannot get involved.
He stood up and hurried for the door.
Stay here. I'll make arrangements and be right back.
But the safe deposit box, Sophie declared, we can't just leave.
There's nothing I can do, Vernet said, hurrying out the door. I'm sorry.
Sophie stared after him a moment, wondering if maybe the account number was buried in one of the countless letters and packages her grandfather had sent her over the years, and which she had left unopened. Langdon stood suddenly, and Sophie sensed an unexpected glimmer of contentment in his eyes.
Robert, you're smiling.
Your grandfather was a genius.
I'm sorry?
10 digits? Sophie had no idea what he was talking about. The account number, he said, a familiar lopsided grin now crossing his face. I'm pretty sure he left it for us after all.
Where?
Langdon produced the printout of the crime scene photo and spread it out on the coffee table. Sophie needed only to read the first line to know Langdon was correct. 13, 3, 2, 21, 1, 1, 8, 5. O draconian devil, O lame saint. P.S. Find Robert Langdon. Chapter 44
10 digits,
Sophie said, her cryptologic senses tingling as she studied the printout. 13, 3, 2, 21, 1, 1, 8, 5.
Grandpère wrote his account number on the Louvre floor.
When Sophie had first seen the scrambled Fibonacci sequence on the parquet, she had assumed its sole purpose was to encourage DCPJ to call in their cryptographers and get Sophie involved. Later, she realized the numbers were also a clue as how to decipher the other lines.
A sequence out of order. A numeric anagram.
Now, utterly amazed, she saw the numbers had a more important meaning still. They were almost certainly the final key to opening her grandfather's mysterious safe deposit box.
He was a master of double entendre, Sophie said, turning to Langdon. He loved anything with multiple layers of meaning, codes within codes.
Langdon was already moving toward the electronic podium near the conveyor belt. Sophie grabbed the computer printout and followed. The podium had a keypad similar to a bank ATM terminal. The screen displayed the bank's cruciform logo. Beside the keypad was a triangular hole. Sophie wasted no time inserting the shaft of her key into the hole. The screen refreshed instantly. Account number. The cursor blinked, waiting.
10 digits.
Sophie read the numbers off the printout, and Langdon typed them in. Account number 13322111185. The instant he had typed the last digit, the screen refreshed again. A message in several languages appeared. English was on top. Caution. Before you strike the enter key, please check the accuracy of your account number. For your own security, if the computer does not recognize your account number, this system will automatically shut down.
Fonction terminée, Sophie said, frowning. Looks like we only get one try.
Standard ATM machines allowed users 3 attempts to type a PIN before confiscating their bank card. This was obviously no ordinary cash machine.
The number looks right, Langdon confirmed, carefully checking what Sophie had typed and comparing it to the printout.
He motioned to the enter key.
Fire away.
Sophie extended her index finger toward the keypad but hesitated, an odd thought now hitting her.
Go ahead, Langdon urged. Vernet will be back any time.
No. She pulled her hand away. This isn't the right account number.
Of course it is. 10 digits. What else would it be?
It's too random.
Too random?
Langdon could not have disagreed more. Every bank advised its customers to choose PINs at random so nobody could guess them. Certainly clients here would be advised to choose their account numbers at random.
Sophie was already deleting everything he had just typed in.
Robert, we just made an error we cryptologists call supposer la conséquence. We solved the code backwards. We assumed the conclusion and concluded the assumption.
Langdon had no idea what she was talking about. Sophie completed deleting the entry and looked up at him, her gaze self-assured.
It's far too coincidental that this supposedly random account number could be rearranged to form the Fibonacci sequence.
Langdon realized she had a point. Earlier, Sophie had rearranged this account number into the Fibonacci sequence. What were the odds of being able to do that? Sophie was at the keypad again, entering a different number, as if from memory.
Moreover, with my grandfather's love of symbolism and codes, it seems to follow that he would have chosen an account number that had meaning to him, something he could easily remember.
She finished typing the entry and gave a sly smile.
Something that appeared random, but was not.
Langdon looked at the screen. Account number 11235813321. It took him an instant, but when Langdon spotted it, he knew she was right.
The Fibonacci sequence.
11235813321. When the Fibonacci sequence was melded into a single 10-digit number, it became virtually unrecognizable.
Easy to remember and yet seemingly random.
A brilliant 10-digit code that Sonnier would never forget. Furthermore, it perfectly explained why the scrambled numbers on the Louvre floor could be rearranged to form the famous progression. Sophie reached down and pressed the enter key. Nothing happened. At least, nothing they could detect. At that moment, beneath them, in the bank's cavernous subterranean vault, a robotic claw sprang to life. Sliding on a double-axis transport system attached to the ceiling, the claw headed off in search of the proper coordinates. On the cement floor below, hundreds of identical plastic crates lay aligned on an enormous grid, like rows of small coffins in an underground crypt. Whirring to a stop over the correct spot on the floor, the claw dropped down, an electric eye confirming the barcode on the box. Then, with computer precision, the claw grasped the heavy handle and hoisted the crate vertically. New gears engaged, and the claw transported the box to the far side of the vault, coming to a stop over a stationary conveyor belt. Gently now, the retrieval arm set down the crate and retracted. Once the arm was clear, the conveyor belt whirred to life. Upstairs, Sophie and Langdon exhaled in relief to see the conveyor belt move. Standing beside the belt, they felt like weary travelers at baggage claim awaiting a mysterious piece of luggage they had never seen. The conveyor belt entered the room on their right through a narrow slit beneath a retractable door. The metal door slid up with a thud, and a huge plastic box appeared, emerging from the depths on the inclined conveyor belt. The box was black, heavy molded plastic, and far larger than she imagined. It looked like an air freight pet transport crate without any air holes. The box coasted to a stop directly in front of them. Langdon and Sophie stood there, silent, staring at the mysterious container. Like everything else about this bank, This crate was industrial. Metal clasps, a barcode sticker on top, and molded heavy-duty handle. Sophie thought it looked like a giant toolbox. Wasting no time, Sophie unhooked the two buckles facing her. Then she glanced over at Langdon. Together they raised the heavy lid and let it fall back. Stepping forward, they peered down into the crate. At first glance, Sophie thought the crate was empty. Then she saw it, sitting at the bottom of the crate, a lone item. The polished wooden box was about the size of a shoebox and had ornate hinges. The wood was a lustrous deep purple with a strong grain.
Rosewood, Sophie realized,
her grandfather's favorite. The lid bore a beautiful inlaid design of a rose. She and Langdon exchanged puzzled looks. Sophie leaned in and grabbed the box, lifting it out.
My God, it's heavy.
She carried it gingerly to a large receiving table and set it down. Langdon stood beside her, both of them staring at the small treasure chest her grandfather apparently had sent them to retrieve. Langdon stared in wonderment at the lid's hand-carved inlay, a five-petal rose. He had seen this type of rose many times.
The five-petal rose, he whispered, is a priory symbol for the Holy Grail.
Sophie turned and looked at him. Langdon could see what she was thinking, and he was thinking it too. The dimensions of the box, the apparent weight of its contents, and a priory symbol for the Grail all seemed to imply one unfathomable conclusion.
The cup of Christ is in this wooden box.
Langdon again told himself it was impossible.
It's a perfect size, Sophie whispered, to hold a chalice.
It can't be a chalice.
Sophie pulled the box toward her across the table, preparing to open it. As she moved it, though, something unexpected happened. The box let out an odd gurgling sound. Langdon did a double take.
There's liquid inside?
Sophie looked equally confused.
Did you just hear?
Langdon nodded, lost. Liquid. Reaching forward, Sophie slowly unhooked the clasp and raised the lid. The object inside was unlike anything Langdon had ever seen. One thing was immediately clear to both of them, however. This was definitely not the cup of Christ. Chapter 45.
The police are blocking the street, André Vernet said, walking into the waiting room. Getting you out will be difficult.
As he closed the door behind him, Vernet saw the heavy-duty plastic case on the conveyor belt and halted in his tracks.
My God, they accessed Sonia's account.
Sophie and Langdon were at the coffee table, huddling over what looked to be a large wooden jewelry box. Sophie immediately closed the lid and looked up.
We had the account number after all, she said.
This changed everything. Vernet respectfully diverted his eyes from the box and tried to figure out his next move.
I have to get them out of the bank.
But with the police already having set up a roadblock, Vernet could imagine only one way to do that.
Miss Neveu, if I can get you safely out of the bank, will you be taking the item with you or returning it to the vault before you leave?
Sophie glanced at Langdon and then back to Vernet.
We need to take it.
Vernet nodded.
Very well. Then whatever the item is, I suggest you wrap it in your jacket as we move through the hallways. I would prefer nobody else see it.
As Langdon shed his jacket, Vernet hurried over to the conveyor belt, closed the now empty crate, and typed a series of simple commands. The conveyor belt began moving again, carrying the plastic container back down to the vault. Pulling the gold key from the podium, he handed it to Sophie.
This way, please. Hurry.
When they reached the rear loading dock, Vernet could see the flash of police lights filtering through the underground garage. He frowned. They were probably blocking the ramp.
Am I really going to try to pull this off?
He was sweating now. Vernet motioned to one of the bank's small armored trucks.
Transport Sur was another service offered by the Depository Bank of Zurich. Get in the cargo hold, he said, heaving open the massive rear door and motioning to the glistening steel compartment. I'll be right back.
As Sophie and Langdon climbed in, Vernet hurried across the loading dock to the dock overseer's office, let himself in, collected the keys for the truck, and found a driver's uniform jacket and cap. Shedding his own suit coat and tie, he began to put on the driver's jacket. Reconsidering, he donned a shoulder holster beneath the uniform. On his way out, he grabbed a driver's pistol from the rack, put in a clip, and stuffed it in the holster, buttoning his uniform over it. Returning to the truck, Vernet pulled the driver's cap down low and peered in at Sophie and Langdon, who were standing inside the empty steel box.
"You'll want this on," Vernet said, reaching inside and flicking a wall switch to illuminate the lone courtesy bulb on the hold's ceiling. "And you'd better sit down. Not a sound on our way out the gate."
Sophie and Langdon sat down on the metal floor. Langdon cradled the treasure wadded in his tweed jacket. Swinging the heavy doors closed, Vernet locked them inside. Then he got in behind the wheel and revved the engine. As the armored truck lumbered toward the top of the ramp, Vernet could feel the sweat already collecting beneath his driver's cap. He could see there were far more police lights in front than he had imagined. As the truck powered up the ramp, the interior gate swung inward to let him pass. Vernet advanced and waited while the gate behind him closed, before pulling forward and tripping the next sensor. The second gate opened, and the exit beckoned.
"Except for the police car blocking the top of the ramp."
Vernet dabbed his brow and pulled forward. A lanky officer stepped out and waved him to a stop a few meters from the roadblock. Four squad cars were parked out front. Vernet stopped. Pulling his driver's cap down farther, he affected as rough a facade as his cultured upbringing could feign, and opened the door. Not budging from behind the wheel, he gazed down at the agent. The man's face was stern and sallow.
"Qu'est-ce qui se passe?"
Vernet asked, his tone rough.
"Je suis Jérôme Collet," the agent said. "Agent lieutenant, police judiciaire." He motioned to the truck's cargo hold. "Qu'est-ce qu'il y a à la dedans?"
"Hell if I know," Vernet replied in crude French. "I'm only a driver."
Collet looked unimpressed.
"We are looking for two criminals."
Vernet laughed.
"Then you came to the right spot. Some of these bastards I drive for have so much money they must be criminals."
The agent held up a passport picture of Robert Langdon.
"Was this man in your bank tonight?"
Vernet shrugged.
"No clue. I'm a dock rat. They don't let us anywhere near the clients. You need to go in and ask the front desk."
"Your bank is demanding a search warrant before we can enter."
Vernet put on a disgusted look.
"Administrators, don't get me started."
"Open your truck, please." Collet motioned toward the cargo hold. Vernet stared at the agent and forced an obnoxious laugh.
"Open the truck? You think I have keys? You think they trust us? You should see the crap wages I get paid."
The agent's head tilted to one side, his skepticism evident.
"You're telling me you don't have keys to your own truck?"
Vernet shook his head.
"Not the cargo area. Ignition only. These trucks get sealed by overseers on the loading dock. Then the truck sits in dock while someone drives the cargo keys to the drop-off. Once we get the call that the cargo keys are with the recipient, then I get the okay to drive. Not a second before. I never know what the hell I'm lugging."
"When was this truck sealed?"
"Must have been hours ago. I'm driving all the way up to Santorial tonight. Cargo keys are already up there."
The agent made no response, his eyes probing as if trying to read Vernet's mind. A drop of sweat was preparing to slide down Vernet's nose.
"You mind?"
he said, wiping his nose with his sleeve and motioning to the police car blocking his way.
"I'm on a tight schedule."
"Do all the drivers wear Rolex?"
the agent asked, pointing to Vernet's wrist. Vernet glanced down and saw the glistening band of his absurdly expensive Rolex peeking out from beneath the sleeve of his jacket.
"Merde. This piece of shit? Bought it for 20 euro from a Taiwanese street vendor in Saint-Germain-du-Pré. I sell it to you for 40.
The agent paused and finally stepped aside.
"No thanks. Have a safe trip."
Vernet did not breathe again until the truck was a good 50 meters down the street. And now he had another problem.
Where do I take them?
Chapter 46.
Silas lay prone on the straw mat in his room, allowing the lash wounds on his back to clot in the air. Tonight's second session with the discipline had left him dizzy and weak. He had yet to remove the Silas belt, and he could feel the blood trickling down his inner thigh. Still, he could not justify removing the strap.
I have failed the church. Far worse, I have failed the bishop.
Tonight was supposed to be Bishop Aringarosa's salvation. 5 months ago, the bishop had returned from a meeting at the Vatican Observatory, where he had learned something that left him deeply changed. Depressed for weeks, Aringarosa had finally shared the news with Silas.
"But this is impossible," Silas had cried out. "I cannot accept it."
"It is true," Aringarosa said. "Unthinkable, but true. In only 6 months." The bishop's words terrified Silas. He prayed for deliverance, and even in those dark days, his trust in God and the way never wavered. It was only a month later that the clouds parted miraculously, and the light of possibility shone through. Divine intervention, Aringarosa had called it. The bishop had seemed hopeful for the first time.
"Silas," he whispered, "God has bestowed upon us an opportunity to protect the way. Our battle, like all battles, will take sacrifice. Will you be a soldier of God?"
Silas fell to his knees before Bishop Aringarosa, the man who had given him a new life, and he said,
"I am a lamb of God. Shepherd me as your heart commands."
When Aringarosa described the opportunity that had presented itself, Silas knew it could only be the hand of God at work.
Miraculous fate.
Aringarosa put Silas in contact with the man who had proposed the plan, the man who called himself the teacher. Although the teacher and Silas never met face to face, each time they spoke by phone, Silas was awed, both by the profundity of the teacher's faith and by the scope of his power. The teacher seemed to be a man who knew all, a man with eyes and ears in all places. How the teacher gathered his information, Silas did not know, but Aringarosa had placed enormous trust in the teacher, and he had told Silas to do the same.
"Do as the teacher commands you," the bishop told Silas, "and we will be victorious."
Victorious.
Silas now gazed at the bare floor and feared victory had eluded them. The teacher had been tricked. The keystone was a devious dead end. And with the deception, all hope had vanished. Silas wished he could call Bishop Aringarosa and warn him, but the teacher had removed all their lines of direct communication tonight.
For our safety.
Finally, overcoming enormous trepidation, Silas crawled to his feet and found his robe, which lay on the floor. He dug his cell phone from the pocket. Hanging his head in shame, he dialed.
"Teacher," he whispered. "All is lost."
Silas truthfully told the man how he had been tricked.
"You lose your faith too quickly," the teacher replied. "I have just received news, most unexpected and welcome. The secret lives. Jacques Saunier transferred information before he died. I will call you soon. Our work tonight is not yet done."
Chapter 47. Riding inside the dimly lit cargo hold of the armored truck was like being transported inside a cell for solitary confinement. Langdon fought the all-too-familiar anxiety that haunted him in confined spaces.
"Vernet said he would take us a safe distance out of the city. Where? How far?"
Langdon's legs had gotten stiff from sitting cross-legged on the metal floor, and he shifted his position, wincing to feel the blood pouring back into his lower body. In his arms, he still clutched the bizarre treasure they had extricated from the bank.
"I think we are on the highway now," Sophie whispered.
Langdon sensed the same thing. The truck, after an unnerving pause atop the bank ramp, had moved on, snaking left and right for a minute or two, and was now accelerating to what felt like top speed. Beneath them, the bulletproof tires hummed on smooth pavement. Forcing his attention to the rosewood box in his arms, Langdon laid the precious bundle on the floor, unwrapped his jacket, and extracted the box, pulling it toward him. Sophie shifted her position so they were sitting side by side. Langdon suddenly felt like they were two kids huddled over a Christmas present. In contrast to the warm colors of the rosewood box, the inlaid rose had been crafted of a pale wood, probably ash, which shone clearly in the dim light. The rose. Entire armies and religions had been built on this symbol, as had secret societies. The Rosicrucians, the Knights of Rosy Cross, the Rose Crew.
"Go ahead," Sophie said. "Open it."
Langdon took a deep breath. Reaching for the lid, he stole one more admiring glance at the intricate woodwork and then, unhooking the clasp, he opened the lid, revealing the object within. Langdon had harbored several fantasies about what they might find inside this box, but clearly he had been wrong on every account. Nestled snugly inside the box's heavily padded interior of crimson silk lay an object Langdon could not even begin to comprehend. Crafted of polished white marble, it was a stone cylinder approximately the dimensions of a tennis ball can. More complicated than a simple column of stone, however, the cylinder appeared to have been assembled in many pieces. Six donut-sized discs of marble had been stacked and affixed to one another within a delicate brass framework. It looked like some kind of tubular multi-wheeled kaleidoscope. Each end of the cylinder was affixed with an end cap, also marble, making it impossible to see inside. Having heard liquid within, Langdon assumed the cylinder was hollow. As mystifying as the construction of the cylinder was, however, it was the engravings around the tube's circumference that drew Langdon's primary focus. Each of the six discs had been carefully carved with the same unlikely series of letters, the entire alphabet. The lettered cylinder reminded Langdon of one of his childhood toys, a rod threaded with lettered tumblers that could be rotated to spell different words.
"Amazing, isn't it?" Sophie whispered.
Langdon glanced up. "I don't know. What the hell is it?" Now there was a glint in Sophie's eye.
"My grandfather used to craft these as a hobby. They were invented by Leonardo da Vinci."
Even in the diffuse light, Sophie could see Langdon's surprise.
"Da Vinci," he muttered, looking again at the canister.
"Yes, it's called a cryptex. According to my grandfather, the blueprints come from one of Da Vinci's secret diaries."
"What is it for?"
Considering tonight's events, Sophie knew the answer might have some interesting implications.
"It's a vault," she said, "for storing secret information."
Langdon's eyes widened further. Sophie explained that creating models of Da Vinci's inventions was one of her grandfather's best-loved hobbies. A talented craftsman who spent hours in his wood and metal shop, Jacques Saunier enjoyed imitating master craftsmen, Fabergé, assorted cloisonné artisans, and the less artistic but far more practical, Leonardo da Vinci. Even a cursory glance through Da Vinci's journals revealed why the great luminary was as notorious for his lack of follow-through as he was famous for his brilliance. Da Vinci had drawn up blueprints for hundreds of inventions he had never built. One of Jacques Saunier's favorite pastimes was bringing Da Vinci's more obscure brainstorms to life. Timepieces, water pumps, cryptexes, and even a fully articulated model of a medieval French knight, which now stood proudly on the desk in his office. Designed by Da Vinci in 1495 as an outgrowth of his earliest anatomy and kinesiology studies, the internal workings of the robot knight possessed accurate joints and tendon mechanisms, and was designed to sit up, wave its arms, and move its head via a flexible neck while opening and closing an anatomically correct jaw. This armor-clad knight, Sophie had always believed, was the most beautiful object her grandfather had ever built. That was, until she had seen the cryptex in this rosewood box.
"He made me one of these when I was little," Sophie said, "but I've never seen one as ornate and large."
Langdon's eyes had never left the box. "I've never heard of a cryptex." Sophie was not surprised. Most of Leonardo's unbuilt inventions had never been studied or even named. The term cryptex possibly had been her grandfather's creation, an apt title for this device that used the science of cryptology to protect information written on the contained scroll or codex. Da Vinci had been a cryptology pioneer, Sophie knew, although he was seldom given credit. Sophie's university instructors, while presenting computer encryption methods for securing data, praised modern cryptologists like Zimmerman and Schneier, but failed to mention that it was Leonardo who had invented one of the first rudimentary forms of public key encryption centuries ago. Sophie's grandfather, of course, had been the one to tell her all about that. As their armored truck roared down the highway, Sophie explained to Langdon that the cryptex had been Da Vinci's solution to the dilemma of sending secure messages over long distances. In an era without telephones or email, anyone wanting to convey private information to someone far away had no option but to write it down and then trust a messenger to carry the letter. Unfortunately, if a messenger suspected the letter might contain valuable information, he could make far more money selling the information to adversaries than he could delivering the letter properly. Many great minds in history had invented cryptologic solutions to the challenge of data projection. Julius Caesar devised a code-writing scheme called the Caesar Box. Mary, Queen of Scots, created a transposition cipher and sent secret communiques from prison. And the brilliant Arab scientist Abu Yusuf Ismail al-Kindi protected his secrets with an ingeniously conceived polyalphabetic substitution cipher. Da Vinci, however, eschewed mathematics and cryptology for a mechanical solution, the cryptex, a portable container that could safeguard letters, maps, diagrams, anything at all. Once information was sealed inside the cryptex, only the individual with the proper password could access it.
"We require a password," Sophie said, pointing out the lettered dials. "A cryptex works much like a bicycle's combination lock. If you align the dials in the proper position, the lock slides open. This cryptex has 5 lettered dials. When you rotate them to their proper sequence, the tumblers inside align, and the entire cylinder slides apart."
"And inside?"
"Once the cylinder slides apart, you have access to a hollow central compartment, which can hold a scroll of paper on which is the information you want to keep private."
Langdon looked incredulous. "And you say your grandfather built these for you when you were younger?"
"Some smaller ones, yes. A couple of times for my birthday, he gave me a cryptex and told me a riddle. The answer to the riddle was the password to the cryptex, and once I figured it out, I could open it up and find my birthday card."
"Lot of work for a card."
"No, the cards always contained another riddle or clue. My grandfather loved creating elaborate treasure hunts around our house, a string of clues that eventually led to my real gift. Each treasure hunt was a test of character and merit to ensure I earned my rewards, and the tests were never simple."
Langdon eyed the device again, still looking skeptical. "But why not just pry it apart or smash it? The metal looks delicate and marble is a soft rock."
Sophie smiled.
"Because Da Vinci is too smart for that. He designed the cryptex so that if you try to force it open in any way, the information self-destructs. Watch."
Sophie reached into the box and carefully lifted out the cylinder.
"Any information that is to be inserted is first written on a papyrus scroll."
"Not vellum?"
Sophie shook her head.
"Papyrus. I know sheep's vellum was more durable and more common in those days, but it had to be papyrus. The thinner, the better."
"Okay."
"Before the papyrus was inserted into the cryptex's compartment, it was rolled around a delicate glass vial."
She tipped the cryptex, and the liquid inside gurgled.
"A vial of liquid."
"Liquid what?" Sophie smiled.
"Vinegar."
Langdon hesitated a moment, and then began nodding. "Brilliant."
"Vinegar and papyrus," Sophie thought.
If someone attempted to force open the cryptex, the glass vial would break, and the vinegar would quickly dissolve the papyrus. By the time anyone extracted the secret message, it would be a glob of meaningless pulp.
"As you can see," Sophie told him, "the only way to access the information inside is to know the proper 5-letter password. And with 5 dials, each with 26 letters, that's 26 to the 5th power."
She quickly calculated the permutations in her head.
"Approximately 12 million combinations."
"If you say so," Langdon said, looking like he had approximately 12 million questions running through his head.
What information do you think is inside?
Whatever it is, my grandfather obviously wanted very badly to keep it secret.
She paused, closing the box lid and eyeing the five-petal rose inlaid on the lid. Something was bothering her.